This week on Retronauts, follow the white rabbit if you want, but follow the yellow rabbit at your own peril. Welcome to Retronauts. I'm your host for this week, Nadia Oxford. I need you to fetch the soggiest, saddest, sloppiest piece of pizza you could think of, or the most disgusting pizza you've ever touched in your life, because I am going to talk about the horror sensation game of the tens, if you want to call them the tens, that is Five Nights at Freddy's. And yes, it is retro, according to our the Retronauts rulebook. I guess, I don't know if we have one, but let's just say that we do. The point is, Five Nights at Freddy's is old, and you should feel old. And that goes double for anyone who has kids, including my guest this week, fellow writer and FNAF fan over 13 years old, Matt Bradley-Shergi. Hey, Matt, thanks for coming.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
Yeah, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure.
I think you've been on the show before.
I have. It was a few years ago with Jeremy Parrish and someone else, I can't remember who. I used to do Sequel Cast 2 and Friends, which was a movie and video game podcast that was part of the Greenlit Network, podcast network. A while ago, but you can find those at sequelcast2.com. But I write books. I'm based out of Portland, Oregon. I recently came out with Star Trek Video Games, an unofficial guide to the final frontier.
Nice.
I spoke on a Star Trek Video Games panel just a few weeks ago at Star Trek to Las Vegas at the Rio.
Wow.
Which was really cool as part of the Inglorious Trekspert's stage, which they're a podcast, and they had programming all 4 days of the show, which is crazy, but it was pretty cool. And I also recently was an editor on Uwe Boll's memoir in English, Uwe Boll Raw, a memoir.
Oh, nice. I have to read that one.
Yeah, it just came out.
Infamous name.
Yes. It covers his life and the movies, and I think the stuff about his life might surprise people.
Yeah, I bet a few things about that guy would surprise us, but mm-hmm. That sounds really cool. Have you ever met I don't even remember if you podcasted with Kat Bailey at all or met her.
Yes, she was on. I think all three of us were on a Axe of the Blood God talking about Dragon Quest V.
That's right. Yes, that's a great episode. Actually, I think it's available a la carte if you want to go to anyone listening to this wants to go to our Axe of the Blood God Patreon and buy that for a few bucks. Yeah, Kat, of course, is a humongous Star Trek nerd. So
yeah,
if you talk to her,
I interviewed
about,
her
like,
for the book. So yeah, she it was a lot of fun.
Oh, she must have had plenty to say. Yeah, she's like so huge into Star Trek.
Especially Star Trek Online, she was really into
yes.
for quite some time. Yep.
She was, I think that was her, like we all have our MMOs, and that was hers for a very long time, she said, and she describes it all the time on Axe of the Blood God. It's, yep, she's a super fan, right? She's a real Trekkie.
I've been listening to her stuff since, the OneUp.com days, like 20-something years ago, so... Or however long ago.
Oh my God. Active Time Babble.
Yes.
And all of that.
Yes.
What a great name.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. Spoiler alert. We were actually thinking of naming Axe of the Blood God that if we weren't able to get the Blood God name rights after US Gamer shut down. But thankfully, they gave us the rights, and that was actually quite nice of them.
Nice.
But yeah. How was Las Vegas, by the way? When I went there for FanFest, for Final Fantasy XIV FanFest, I nearly died. The weather was just too hot for me.
Yeah, I mean, it was in August, so, and it was my first time speaking at a convention outside of Oregon, which that part was cool, and I got to take my wife as a plus one, which they don't always do at conventions anymore, and that was great.
That's very true. That's very nice of them.
But anyhow, I mean, it was like, got up to 109 degrees. We did not stay at the Rio because my dad had a timeshare at the Flamingo, and you could take a taxi for like 10 bucks or something, so that was a better option. But just, even at night, it felt like you were boiling. I happen to like the heat. Like, I was fine with it, but my friends I was with, not so much.
No, I'm a very soft Canadian.
But it was really cool. I mean, I got to see, you forget how many people guessed it on Star Trek. Like, Ray Wise was there, the dad from Twin Peaks. Like, to see him in person kind of blew my mind. And just a lot of cool people. The merch was, like, quite expensive, too. I was the most expensive thing.
It's very expensive at cons.
I saw was, like, a painting from the original four Star Trek shows. So Star Trek, Next Generation, DS9, and Voyager of different characters. And it had maybe 30 signatures on that I assume were verified. And it was going for $4,500.
Wow.
I don't know if it sold, but I wouldn't spend that much on it. But I think some people would. So like,
well, even though we're here to talk about FNAF, actually, yes, I have to tell you, I'm sure you've heard this story before, or maybe you haven't, but did you hear my story about the time William Shatner was in my backyard?
No, I haven't heard that one.
Okay, that was actually really funny. I grew up in a house that backed onto the parking lot of a indoor hockey rink. And it was a pretty significant hockey rink, like the Maple Leafs used to practice there and whatnot. And one day, my mom just looks out the window of our backyard and says, that's William Shatner. Like, there's a movie set there, and William Shatner's sitting there. So my brother and his friend and I, we go over, and William Shatner's just sitting there. Yeah, he was filming Tech War. Do you remember Tech War?
Yes, I do. And I've read some of the books. The video game I haven't played, but I should probably try to stream it sometime.
I didn't know there was a game.
It has full that's motion hilarious. Videos with him in character, and it's by Capstone. It's got a pretty awful reputation, but that makes me more interested in it.
I know the show lasted a few episodes, maybe, and the scene, there's a scene where like an android is in a hockey rink and he throws a hockey stick. And I actually got to watch that be filmed because he let us come in and watch it be filmed. And yeah, my brother had a signature on just like a piece of paper. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I met Shatner briefly with my my wife and I have done the Star Trek cruise a few times. Which is a lot of fun. And when we got the picture taken with him, he was sort of tired, but which is expected. But like the people,
I understand.
The guy behind us got on his hands and knees in front of Shatner. Like photo lines are great for people watching. He got on his hands and knees and bowed to him. And I had to bite my lip to keep from laughing. And I'm sure Shatner's seen it all. He was a real pro. But like, you know, when people see their idols in person, they can react in funny ways.
They really can. That's a little creepy. I would be a little bit squicked out if someone did that to me. But as you said, Shatner's probably an old pro by this point, and he's seen it all. Oh, goodness. Star Trek. Fandom in general. And fandom is actually something that's a big part of FNAF, which, again, we are talking about today, I promise you. Matt, why don't you tell us a little bit about why you even know anything about Five Nights at Freddy's? I know that most people who have kids or had kids at that point in time know something about these animatronics.
Right. I don't have kids and I'm 42. And the reason why I know about it.
Okay. I love this because it's an adult FNAF fan podcast. We're good.
Okay. Great. Fantastic. The thing is, like, I follow game news like a nut since I was a kid and had a subscription to like PC Gamer and Nintendo Power. And so these sites like Kotaku just wouldn't shut up about Five Nights at Freddy's. So Steam had a bundle of, I think, the first four games and the Location.
Yeah.
Thank you. And I downloaded it and played it. And we talked about this a bit in the chat before we started the show, but like I grew up going to Showbiz Pizza and Chuck E. Cheese. And what fascinates me about Five Nights at Freddy's is like those things don't really exist anymore, especially after COVID. And yet like the movie was still really popular. So you have a game based on a real location that the audience never went to or experienced in the same way.
That's a very good point. Yeah.
Right. And like back when arcade games looked much better than stuff at home.
Yeah, for sure. Where did you grow up? Did you grow up in the South?
I grew up in Latin America for 6 years as a kid because my dad worked for the government. Cool. And then we moved to the South in Atlanta or Marietta, Georgia, which is near Atlanta. But we, a time there, we lived with my grandma in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. And I think over in Pittsburgh, you could go down the mountain and go to those pizza places. So I was maybe, you know, like seven or something the first time I went.
Yeah. There was never a Showbiz Pizza in Canada that I know of, but, am I thinking wrong, or were those like kind of more southern, maybe slightly religious themed
I believe
pizza
you're right.
Places?
I recall a Noah's Ark game that was a piece of shit where you just like run around and select two animals, go back in the ark and go like,
yeah.
I don't remember the mascot animal characters, being religious necessarily, but I think you're right. And I'd only been to the when I was very little, and then later it got replaced with Chuck E. Cheese. And even as a kid, I didn't like change, and I was like, "This is bullshit. I want Chuck E. You know, I want the Showbiz pizza." But the pizza like tasted largely the same. I'm not sure if they're run by the same company, but I think so.
I think now they maybe, might be, yeah. But yeah. I had a friend who worked in Showbiz Pizza, and I never forgot. She described how she had to destroy tickets that weren't being used or whatever. And they did so by taking a big bucket of water and just putting the tickets in there, and you had to mush them around, and her hands were dyed up to her elbows all summer.
I got a good Chuck E. Cheese story. Do you mind if I get a little gross?
Oh, of course. Now, we're all about gross here at Retronauts by Nadia.
Retronauts was going to be called Retro Gross at one point, but yeah. So, yeah. A friend of mine worked at a Chuck E. Cheese in the South, and he was actually Chuck E. Cheese at some point. And he said kids would kick him in the nuts constantly. And like, and so on his last day, he was so fed up with it, he took a shit in the mask in the head of Chuck E. Cheese and left it locked in the closet on like a hot day just to really get back at them. And I told that story in one of my writer's groups, and like the guys thought it was amazing, and like some of the women were just disgusted. And the reaction just depends on the kind of humor of the people, but it was very
telling. As you can tell, I broke up laughing, especially since FNAF. We'll get into the lore a bit later, but yeah, there is a very specific point about bad smells coming from the suits in the game.
That's right.
It's like, oh good, it's, no one took a shit. It's just murdered kids. Wew. Okay, we're fine. No, I as I said, I never went to Showbiz Pizza. That Noah's Ark game that you mentioned, it does exist. It's by Wisdom Tree. It's of course an illegal NES game, I think.
It's a different game actually. The one in the arcade was overhead, like Zelda perspective.
Oh,
but same idea though. I've played the Wisdom Tree NES game.
Ah,
But anyhow, yeah, it's same kind of idea. It wasn't very good.
No, I'm actually fascinated.
Like Bible quotes on the screen, you know, between levels. They would always sneak those in.
You know, you could make a really metal game about the Bible. And I mean, that's something mm-hmm. that Scott Cawthon, the creator of Five Nights at Freddy's, he tried to do.
That's right.
And again, I'll get into that in a moment, but I just want to say my specific Chuck E. Cheese memory and why maybe it's part of the reason I was just so attracted to this weirdness in the first place. Like you, I'm old enough to remember these places. As I said, there was no Showbiz Pizza, but we did go to Chuck E. Cheese a few times, like for my brother's birthday. And even then, those places, something about them smelled so weird and run down, and the ball pit swallowed children. And it was kind of a fascinating, almost scary place, but I adored it for that reason. Like, my location had these little mouse holes that you could crawl into, and one time they were closed because there's a bunch of broken glass in them, and that just fascinated me. Like, wow, broken glass at Chuck E. Cheese. How could that exist? As you can tell, I was always a chaotic little child. Mm. So just the veneer, if I'm using the right word here, of happiness and songs and friends over what's really a kind of a ill-maintained pizza place full of animatronics that don't really work properly. Yeah, of course, Scott Cawthon went this way. We got it together. We got it. We got it together with you. That's right. We got it together forever. It's great to be together. It's really quite a pleasure. Only together. I think we got it.
Yeah, and the Chuck E. Cheese stuff, it was such a part of the culture that, like, even in the 90s, they changed him from being kind of like a plump mouse to being skinny and riding skateboards and having a backwards hat. Like, they changed the mascot a bit with the time.
Yeah, but I remember that kind of charmingly lame-ass Chuck E. Cheese with the hat and the and all of that. But I'm not sure exactly when they started to take animatronics out of Chuck E. Cheese. I feel like they've been in and out of the establishment, but I could see the reason why kids were so fascinated with Five Nights at Freddy's. One reason is because, yeah, maybe their parents told them about these places. Maybe they even experienced them for themselves. But as you said, COVID, like, just kind of annihilated the rock of fire experience,
it
I suppose.
And one last Chuck E. Cheese story, and I swear we'll get to Five Nights at Freddy's.
Oh, absolutely. I love Chuck E. Cheese.
When COVID started, there was, you know, everyone was ordering food at home. And in some places, this happened here in Portland, Oregon, there's a place on like the Grubhub called Pasquale's. And that was actually Chuck E. Cheese delivering their pizza stealthily. Delivering their greasy
microwave
ass,
like, pizza.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah.
That's how they like barely stayed in business, and they had to close the one. But we used to take my nephew a lot, and I felt so old seeing a lot of the arcade games were just like phone games. They had like a Temple Run.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
yeah,
man,
Flappy Bird.
It's different, but like out here we have Portland Retro Game Expo, and we have a good arcade scene out here, and I'm just thankful for that.
Yeah, Chuck E. Cheese, you can do better. Actually, I'd love to go to Portland Retro. I just came back from Long Island Retro, and that was a lot of fun, except for...
That one's great. Yeah.
Oh, it's great, but I had massive flight delay, so I missed a whole day, and right. Yeah, that sucked. But it's still great. Like, what a great venue. Had fun. The original Five Nights at Freddy's, it was a horror game that hit Steam in August of 2014. This was also around the same time YouTube really became a prominent way for... people to build their personalities as they played games and yelled about them, and kind of started with Let's Plays before streaming really took off. But you had some really big name YouTubers rising around the same time as FNAF, like Markiplier and Jacksepticeye and MatPat, who used to dissect the lore of Five Nights at Freddy's. I bet that's going to send the revenue he got from that is probably going to send his kids to college with no problem whatsoever.
You probably can each earn PhDs from the money he gets from that. Like, it's just
crazy.
Like, the popularity is quite something.
I got to hand it to MatPat, though. Like, the fact he just retired like a normal human being from YouTube, like, that's actually very commendable.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at people who try to make it on YouTube, some of them through Five Nights at Freddy's, and they just break down, they burn out, they get destroyed. It's very hard to cross that finish line as a human being, and MatPat, despite some of his big F-ups, like, give, well, I don't know, what do you call it, an F-up when he gave Undertale to the Pope? That was
I think so, but I mean, why not? If you're going to give the Undertale to something, why not the Pope?
Why not give it to the Pope? I once saw a parody of, like, the Pope's Steam deck, Steam profile, and it says he's playing Undertale, and he's just like, what is this shit? How do I kill my mom? I thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah. It. I mean, looking here at Five Nights at Freddy's, it was developed with something called Click Team Fusion, and I've never used that, but I did grow up with something called like Game Maker, and Maxis had a French thing, and I think it's along the same lines of like a low code game design development. I have a 2005 Bachelor's of Fine Arts in Interactive Design and Game Development from Savannah College Art and Design.
Oh, cool.
And so I'm not a great programmer, but I've done game development, and most recently I did the closed beta test for Ken Roberta Williams' remake of Colossal Cave Adventure.
Oh, nice.
Which was
That's awesome.
Cool to work with them. But anyhow, you know, point being, he could pump out these games so quickly because he was using one of these drag and drop game maker things.
Yes.
And some people complain, and I made a game in RPG Maker that people really complained about. Oh, it's RPG Maker. You can make a game in a weekend. And it's like, you could. It won't be a good game. Game development takes so long that, like, unless you've done it, you don't really understand. And it's really commendable that Scott Cawthorn made something that was a hit and then was able to make sequels that were just as successful. Like, it's a miracle any game gets finished.
Yeah, absolutely. Going by the thought that this is around the time that YouTube Let's Plays rose into prominence, this was also the time of, as you said, drag and drop game development. It feels like this is really when indies started to take off and diversify, thanks to 2 years later, for example, with Game Maker, we'd be getting Undertale, which is incredible.
So, like, RPG Maker in college, in RPG Maker, one of the things assignments we got was work in a team and make a game off an existing IP, and we didn't have to have the rights to it. So I did the Japanese film Battle Royale, and we used RPG Maker 2002, which wasn't legally in the state, so I had to download a Japanese to Russian to English translation, and we got it working somehow, even though, you know, most of the buttons were labeled in gibberish and you could figure it out. But like, RPG Maker on the computer was so much easier than I had the PS1 version. And like, that was pretty much unusable unless you had the keyboard and the mouse. And even then, I wouldn't recommend designing a game with a controller unless you have a lot of time on your hands.
Yeah, I used to kind of look at the reviews for RPG Maker because I was mildly interested in game development, I suppose, like any kid at that age. But we had nothing at the time, except maybe for RPG Maker. And I remember reading reviews saying it was kind of complicated to use. But as time went on, I started to notice that we're getting some pretty good games coming out of RPG Maker. And then again, we got, what was the name of the engine that Scott used again?
It is Clickteam Fusion 2.5.
Yeah, see, I've never heard of that, but it sounds like the kind of thing that if you, you know, as you said, even if you know, you think you know something about game development, you don't quite know anything about game development. I mean, I couldn't go in there and make a great game, drag and drop or not, and especially not one with the appeal of Five Nights at Freddy's. But I think part of the appeal there is also almost by accident, because Scott Cawthon like tried many, many times to develop RPGs based on biblical content, like a game based on the 17th century Christian novel Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan. They weren't great games, but neither were they like the broken digital slop that usually gets pitched at Christian bookstores. Like, Matt, you mentioned that Noah's Ark crap.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, the amount of Christian stores in the South, for listeners that don't know, like, you can throw a brick and hit five of them. I mean, we would go there just to get, we would go there with my friends in high school just to get Chick Tracks and leave.
Yes. Oh, right? I collect Chick Tracks. Mm-hmm. I love them.
Those lovely comics. But I believe one of these games that Scott did was at the Chipper and Sons Lumber Company. Like, Jim Sterling made a big video making fun of it that got a lot of attention.
Yeah. I think Jim goes by Stephanie now.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, but you're right. She did actually, oh, that's no problem. She did actually review or look at Cawthon's, one of the games that Cawthon put on Steam Greenlight, which was Chipper and Sons, which is a resource management game. But if you look at the character designs, they are so terrifying. And really, this guy was in the right place, in the right time, but in the wrong place completely. Like, his plane was taking off across the airport, and he was over here in the terminal, and like just the wrong terminal completely.
Sure. And you could kind of call Chipper and Sons Lumber Company Five Nights at Freddy's Zero in a way, I think, because the design of those characters, I really feel inspired.
They really do, yeah.
Some of the creature designs in Freddy's.
I think that Chipper has made guest appearances in some games, at least, by Scott. But what I find very interesting about Scott's games is, again, they weren't exactly like, as I said, that Christian bookstore slop. My theory, my belief is that if you are going to make a game based on Christian/biblical content, by all means, do it. Like, I actually love the idea of a game based on Pilgrim's Progress. And if you look at the game itself, even though it doesn't play extremely well, the demon designs that Cawthon makes, they're pretty good. You can absolutely see why he became famous for his horrible animatronic designs, especially some of the later ones that you get in the later games. He's not bad at designing these things, but unfortunately, ironically, I don't know if the people who kind of like that kind of, who like Christian games and whatnot are necessarily interested in playing ones that are cool and based on like demons and stuff like that. I love the idea of being in an RPG where you fight like, you know, Beelzebub and the representation of regret and sin. And that's pretty cool. I like that.
You could do the angels with the thousand eyes on them, right? Like, you could do things with those designs.
Biblically accurate angels. Right. Yeah, absolutely. He'd nail that for sure. Yeah, so we talked about how his breakthrough came with Chipper and Sons, and Stephanie Sterling said, oh God, what the hell? And Scott got pretty depressed after that. But then he said, he was depressed but not defeated. He had a light bulb moment with the help of God and leaned into this weird talent for modeling childlike terrors he developed a horror game that became a pop culture touchstone for millennials. And yeah, and as we said, it became a hit thanks to so many scream-filled playthroughs by aforementioned YouTubers, because I guess the Lord works in mysterious ways.
Indeed, and part of what impresses me about Five Nights at Freddy's is how minimalist it is.
It is.
You're in that little room, it's first person, it's really limited what you can do, and the storytelling is environmental. Like, it's not terribly didactic. You do have the I'm sure the guy has a name, but like that nerdy guy at the beginning, you know, kind of talking about.
Phone guy.
Yeah, people get their head chopped off here. You better watch out.
Yeah.
Which I think was Scott Cawthorn. Is that right?
That was him. That was his voice. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, he did a good performance with that. But other than that, the game is like an older game in that it kind of doesn't do a tutorial, doesn't ease you into it. It just kind of kicks you down the stairs and hopes you make it at the end.
Yeah, absolutely. Sink or swim. The premise is also so it's Scott has a very dry sense of humor, I find. And actually, one thing I like about his work is you will find references to really retro games like in the later games that he makes, he often includes mini games that use Atari style graphics. Mm-hmm. And this is stuff that I initially played with. So I always kind of have a fondness when I look at those, even though they're often included in terrible, terrible cutscenes where let's just say that Cawthon is really good at hiding violence by kind of scaling down the images, if you know what I mean, like kind of utilizing that Atari aesthetic really effectively for that sort of thing.
And I think it makes it more effective by doing so, because you're not expecting that 8-bit aesthetic to be sort of bloody or surprising. And when you imply violence, like the mind can imagine something much worse than whatever you can see on screen, if it's just like a Gorehound Fangoria kind of close up.
Yeah. I don't think that there's any kind of Atari style retro graphics in the first game. I will say, though, there was a very short-lived RPG that Scott took down. I think he was ashamed of it because he thought it was so bad. But it did contain a quote from Golbez from Final Fantasy IV, so I'll appreciate it for that.
I didn't think it was that bad. It wasn't that good either. It was kind of run-of-the-mill. But to see those characters in a kind of Pokemon knockoff was not a terrible idea.
Yeah. It was free. It was on itch.io, I think. So it's not like we were paying for it. Scott was also always pretty good about realizing, yeah, this isn't like Zelda Breath of the Wild. These are pretty, you know, simple games in many ways, which is why he could get away with releasing so many in such a short time. Like, we got, like, God, I think by the time, within a year, less than a year, we had Five Nights at Freddy's 4. So the series did draw some criticism for being so having like so many games in such a short span of time, but given how small these games were and how they linked together, I think it never bothered me that there was like such a blunderbuss at the time.
Yeah, and it wasn't like he was charging $70 a piece for them either.
$10.
Right, I think that helped with the popularity because you know a kid goes to their mom, hey, can I buy this computer game? It's $10. They'll probably say yes.
Yeah. And another thing to mention also is this is around the time, like Scott couldn't have timed this better, because this is around the time also the rise of iPhone gaming, and Five Nights at Freddy's, to my knowledge, is still on the charts as like one of the most popular paid for apps. Like,
wow.
99 cents got you Five Nights at Freddy's, 99 cents got you FNAF 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever else came. So it really, really took off thanks to Steam and iOS.
Yeah, and like I was just, for research, I was just streaming FNAF 3 last night, and I think I sent you the clip of me like screaming when I got
scared.
And it really, like, the sound design is something that gets overlooked in these games. Like,
I think it's
really effective. It's a bit like a David Lynch film, a lot of low rumbling and weird noises you can't identify, and that helps kind of draw the player into the monitor, and then something jumps out. And I mean, you're right, the YouTube Let's Play React stuff was huge in getting these games popular because it's fun to see people get scared.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting you bring up the sound design because I totally agree. I know that Scott often used, you know, free samples, free library stuff, but he was really good at matching those sounds to certain movements. Like, I know in Five Nights at Freddy's 2, Foxy makes a very specific sound when he moves around in the vents. And that sound, to this day, like, people use it in TikToks and YouTube videos where they want to have a startling, creepy sound and indicate, oh, something bad's about to happen. And yeah, usually in the game, if you heard that sound, Foxy was about to jump out at you. But what a great sound. And like, when you hear it, you recognize it instantly, like, oh, that's Five Nights at Freddy's. Like, and I don't think Scott made that sound or anything like that. It's just he used it so effectively. We'll be right back. actually goes for the first game, too, the way that one of the creepiest things that can happen to you in that game is when you run out of power. Again, this is a weird-ass premise where you are surrounded by angry animatronics for reasons that become obvious in games down the line. And if you run out of power by using too many safety implements, like closing your doors and turning on your lights and whatnot, all of everything will run out at once. And the office just powers down with this really ominous hum. And even the fan, which was such a constant that whole time, you didn't even realize it, that powers down. You truly have that silence that you only get when you lose the power in your house or wherever. And then you hear the Toreador march, and you see these flickering eyes coming down the hallway, and that is your very much your get your affairs in order moment, because Freddy's coming for you. But if you are a few seconds away from 6 a.m., because you got to last from 12 a.m. to 6 a.m., you can still find salvation. You can still win. And I think Markiplier did that at least once in his playthroughs, and of course, his elated screaming was very contagious.
And if you like the Toreador March, you can purchase Christopher Lee's final album. He sings it on there as a track. It's called Metal Knight, and it's a heavy metal arrangement.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah, there was a lot of great fan stuff that came out of the Five Nights at Freddy's phenomenon, like the Living Tombstones and their songs, which I think they had one at the end of the Five Nights at Freddy's movie, didn't they?
They did. And
they used it for the credits.
I mean, the movie I felt sort of mixed on. They spent a long time trying to make it. Originally, Chris Columbus was going to direct it.
I remember that, yeah.
Scott Thorne had full approval, and they went with him over Chris Columbus, the director of the first two Harry Potter movies.
Right.
But when it came out, like, it was really successful. People were kind of poo-pooing it. I think it premiered at Peacock on the same time, or if not, like, pretty damn close to it.
Yeah.
And it did well anyway, so...
Yeah, it did quite well. It actually made, as of this date, over 300 million
wow.
Worldwide, which is not bad at all. And I watched it on the plane to, where, I don't know where I was going, but I watched part of it on the plane there and part of it on the plane back, so it was a short trip. But yeah, I actually kind of liked the movie. I didn't hate it by any means, but it could have had more animatronics for sure. Like, the work on those were fantastic.
Right. Blumhouse Films keeps the budgets low, which I think is pretty smart, but sometimes you can tell, and I think that was the case in this one. But I really liked Matthew Lillard. I thought it was really fun stunt casting, and I think he did a really good job.
Yeah, he did. I think maybe one of the reasons why people were like, you know, why is this movie so popular? What is even this all about? Is because, again, that premise of Five Nights at Freddy's is just like, why would it be a security guard in a place where everything's trying to kill you, and you keep coming back to it? And in my mind, the joke of the game, because again, I think Scott has a very dry sense of humor, is that, well, don't we all kind of drag ourselves to jobs that destroy body and soul day after day for a really crummy paycheck? Yeah, think about it. Actually, I think it was just being funny, but it was pretty funny. It's a funny game.
It is. It's funny and it's scary. And the game had, or the movie had some of that as well.
Yeah, the one thing that the movie did that was really smart is it really leaned into the classic animatronics, which is, of course, Freddy Fazbear himself. You have Bonnie the rabbit, Chica the chicken, and Foxy the fox. And I'm sure I forgot some poor bastard.
Yeah, and I mean, speaking of those characters, did you know they came out with an official tie-in Five Nights at Freddy's cookbook? And if you're going to do
50 Ways to Make Pizza.
Right, if you're going to do a tie-in cookbook, Five Nights at Freddy's is perfect for it. Like, it totally makes sense. For that kind of a product.
I could see having like a lot of fun party foods and like name them sad things like My Best Day and other things that dead children might name their food.
Right. I can't remember the YouTuber, but someone did a video of like he complained that the recipes in the book were not lore heavy enough. So he invented some.
Oh.
And he had like the one of the purple guy as like a food. And it was kind of funny if you Google that.
Yeah, that all ties into, like, it's funny that someone would go to a pizza book and say, but where's the lore? But that is extremely Five Nights at Freddy's. Like, I think what really drew people into the game to begin with was not just the mechanics themselves and the jump scares, but as well as the visuals, but maybe all of that combined with the story that Scott had entwined in this game from day one. And there's a lot of hidden lore hints and story bits in FNAF games, and people have a great time just rooting for it. And, you know, just digging up that stuff, finding what they can find in those, like, sometimes there's something in it. Sometimes it's really well hidden. Like, people have to glitch out some random wall in Five Nights at Freddy's and they'll find, like, what they were looking for. But the first game kept things quite simple. What would happen is, as you're looking around these security cameras trying to, you know, keep tabs on where the animatronics are and what they're doing, you would occasionally see the scenery change and something like a wall that had like a posting of rules for the establishment would suddenly be filled with articles, with headlines that said like, you know, serial killer on the loose, children missing, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, it basically comes to, you come to realize in time, if you can put everything together, that somebody in this bad pizza place once killed a bunch of children and hid their bodies in the suits of the animatronic animals. And in the later games, you kind of learn that one of the reasons these animatronics want to kill you is they just don't like adults for obvious reasons. And that obvious reason would be the purple guy, aka William Afton, aka the serial murderer who just offed a bunch of kids, and still does to this day. He is in the movie, spoiler alert.
He is, and I mean, that's one thing about the movie, not knowing much of the lore, that kind of threw me off, is the beginning is like one of the main characters beating up a guy for kidnapping a kid in a mall.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what kind of movie is this? And eventually, you know, they kind of explain it, but it's a strange way to be one of the first scenes of the movie. And that the element with the children, I think, adds a bit of melancholy to it, and that the game isn't explicit about the plot, that it's environmental, kind of like we were saying earlier, it gets people talking about it, right? It's like,
yeah,
they go like, oh, what about, I think it means this. Oh, I think it means this. And you, well, you know, the creator of the game, Scott Cawthorn, has his interpretation. Once you release it to the public has their interpretation.
Absolutely. Yeah. Definitely death of the author stuff going on there. It probably doesn't help that there are so many Five Nights at Freddy's canons. Like, there's all these different timelines, all these, like, the games have one timeline, the movies another timeline. There's a lot of books and graphic novels. Have you read the Five Nights at Freddy's books, the novels at all?
I've tried to dip into them. I couldn't get into them, but I appreciate that they're there. And that we have a bookstore out here in Portland, Oregon, called Powell's City of Books, and it's 5 stories tall. And in the sci-fi section, or the media tie-in section, Five Nights at Freddy's is like a whole shelf. And
yeah.
When I saw that, I felt old because I didn't know really what it was at the time. And two, I was just really impressed because, you know, you might see, I think there was like 2 Metal Gear Solid novels and that's it. Or the video game novelizations are not huge. I think I had the Mario Brothers Choose Your Own Adventure stuff as a kid.
Oh my God, I have those.
They do. Yeah, those were fun. But did they do a Five Nights at Freddy's Choose Your Own Adventure? I mean, that would make sense, right?
That would make a lot of sense, but I have never heard of one. I would probably play that.
Do you like the books, or what do you think of them?
They're honestly not bad. Coffin has this really weird thing where he writes in a very young adult style. I don't really mean that in a depreciative way. I just mean, like, you know, he writes in a way that's easy for young readers to understand. But then he'll just once in a while break out this brilliant line or description that makes me say, like, wow, that's pretty cool that I read that. But they're fine. They're good for what they are. They're very strange. They make no sense whatsoever, so they're more canon. They're good. I like them. I read the new ones that come out. I read the graphic novels sometimes when they come out. Some of the story collections are pretty good, actually, which is what most of the novels are these days.
I'll have to check those out. One of the games I think I played a little bit was the Pizzeria Simulator.
Yeah. That was Sister Location, I think, and that was really fun because, Scott Cawthon released this game, I think it was 2016, called Freddy Fazbear's Pizza Simulator. And at first, when you load it up on Steam, I didn't play it on iOS, but when you load it up on Steam, yeah, it looks like a standard, like, again, Scott Cawthon parody Atari game, and you're Freddy feeding pizza to the children, yay! And then as you play, it glitches out and turns into an actual Five Nights at Freddy's game. And I thought that was a really interesting start, and especially since I liked this game because it had a lot of contributions from fans And it also gave us a little bit of backstory, what I think is supposed to be backstory, on why the purple guy is psychotic. And if you play this driving game, it seems like a standard driving arcade game, again, one of the mini games that you get in a Five Nights at Freddy's game. But there's a secret exit you can take. And if you take the secret exit, you play as this orange guy who is kicked out of a bar, goes to a house, and it's a really sad house full of sad-looking Atari characters. And it insinuates that this orange guy is the father of Purple Guy, who is an abusive alcoholic. And that's the reason why Purple Guy is the way he is. But that is 50% interpretation, so take it as you will. People say different things, but I think that's just a really interesting bit of storytelling that you're not going to find easily. You got to look for it. And that's when you mix kids and YouTube and things that they can get obsessed about, kids get really obsessed by things very easily. So I can see why Five Nights at Freddy's really hit a nerve with them.
And you and I, Nadia, didn't grow up with YouTube. It wasn't around when we were kids. And so I think we have a different relationship to it, to people that, that did. I mean, at your fingertips, you have more video than you can watch in a lifetime.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you used to have to work, you have to, you know, drive to a store and get a video and drive it back. I mean, the idea now is like absurd, but that was how everyone did it back then, or you'd rent a game, right? So.
Yeah. But I guess even then, when we had just VHSs, we were still like, oh, let's find the secret messages in these Disney movies. Mm-hmm. Oh, look, this tower looks like a penis, therefore it's a mess. We were very bored.
That's right. Yeah. So, right in The Lion King, I think it says sex or something.
It says
pause
sex.
When they
or apparently, down. Apparently, like, no, it says SFX. Yeah, sure it does. but yeah, it was infamous that animators who got bored, especially background animators, they would sometimes, you know, put little messages in the stuff they made. And the thing I remember most is it was popular to rent, was it either The Rescuers Down Under or just The Rescuers? And it was on VHS, and you paused at a specific moment to see a picture of a naked woman, their boobs. It was so silly.
It was the first one.
Yeah. But that was the kind of lore that we hunted for back in the day. So the desire was always there. Scott Cawthon and Five Nights at Freddy's just kind of really offered it up to kids in a way that was easy for them to consume and understand and have fun with.
Is there a genre you'd like to see Five Nights at Freddy's games do?
Oh, that is a good question. It might be I would actually like to see another RPG attempt from Scott. Like, who knows? Five Nights at Freddy's times RPG. That'd be an interesting mix. I like any RPG that can give me unsettling images and sounds. So, yeah, that would go well with me. How about yourself?
I think I would, you know, building on the simulator idea, make it like a real business simulator with spreadsheets,
yes.
But then it would increasingly glitch out and get weird.
I like that.
And maybe people would die and you'd have to cover up the people getting killed. Like, I'm not sure how you'd pull that off, and I don't even know if it would be that popular, but I like the idea of you're trying to run a business while children are being murdered and still trying to keep the happy, happy, fun time, like, veneer on the front. I think there's something there about exploring it from a different angle.
I like that. Yeah. As it stands, the FNAF lore tends to center around Michael, the son of William Afton. And in most games, you get the impression that that Michael is trying to clean up his father's sins to his great detriment at the end. As it turns out, it's kind of a sad ending. Actually, have you played Sister Location? Like, you didn't really finish Sister Location, right? Or see the ending?
No, I didn't. What's the ending of it?
It's very interesting. The thing about Five Nights at Freddy's is that, yes, they had all these murders in this pizza parlor that was owned in part by someone named, I think it was Henry or Harry, who owned the store alongside William Afton and came to realize what was going on. And so the whole premise of Sister Location, you learn, is that it's a false version of Five Nights at Freddy's that was created to lure in Purple Guy, who is now kind of ensnared by the rabbit suit spring trap, barely alive, barely, but not dead either. And basically, Michael was used as a tool by Henry to get him into that store, and so he could set everything on fire, which he does, and everyone burns up, including Michael, who apparently wants to die because everything's so screwed up with his father. Really kind of a messy story, but really dark. Like, there's a lot going on there about abuse and whatnot.
That's quite nice. You know, I do think Five Nights at Freddy inspired this indie game that people overlook from 2022 called Not for Broadcast. I'm going to paste a link in the chat here. And the idea is you're directing a live television show, but based on how you do the live editing, it influences whether one politician wins or the other one does. And it has like fake commercials. It's a lot. It was done in England, a lot of full motion video. It was made during the pandemic. And like, it's really bizarre. I've never seen anything quite like it, but that you're in one room and then stuff keeps breaking. Like maybe there's electricity or a thunderstorm and the machines don't work. There's something about that perspective that made me think of Five Nights at Freddy's might have inspired this game a bit.
Yeah, I like that, especially because as we are pointing out by talking about this game in the first place, the people who grew up with Five Nights at Freddy's are they're making their own games now.
And they have kids, probably.
Yeah. I just kind of, it's funny, I just assumed that you were into Five Nights at Freddy's because you had kids. So many people are like Diamond Fight, who's, of course, with Retronauts. They said their kids are kind of into it and really into the movie. So I just kind of assumed that's if there was an adult who's into Five Nights at Freddy's, it's because they had kids, not because they're a weirdo like me. Like, I actually wrote a lore guide for Five Nights at Freddy's, like kind of explaining what order the games were in, what happens in each one, who the purple guy is, you know, who's this, who's that, what's the point of this. And I think I actually helped people keep things straight. It was a popular guide. I think it's still on VG247. I think it was archived there. So it probably still gets some decent traffic because I'm sure there's still parents who are like, what the hell is my kid talking about?
You know, when I was a kid, I wrote a fan fiction about the Kappa from Final Fantasy VI.
Oh my, that's so cute.
But I don't think it exists, and I'm kind of glad it doesn't. But I did get to visit Japan in 2006 and visit Tono Valley, which has tons of Kappa Valley statues, or Kappa statues.
Oh, nice.
And when we left, the Japanese villagers all gathered and gave us fruit covered in mochi. It felt like something out of a Miyazaki movie, and it was very bizarre to
I love that.
Happen in real life. I think because they didn't get many tourists at the time.
Nobody likes Kappa. Yay. Everyone goes to visit the fox shrines. I would see the Kappa. That's really cool. Why did you decide to write a fanfiction about a Kappa in the first place?
I thought the character in Final Fantasy VI, the Kappa, just looked really cute looking.
He is kind of cute looking, isn't he?
And so I kind of had him be kind, not knowing the lore of the Kappa, I had him be mischievous and pervy, and that ended up being accurate.
Yes.
So,
yeah, I think they pull your guts out of your butthole. They're kind of nasty, which is probably why they don't get many tourists in that village you just told me about.
Right, and let me take this from my shelf. Hold on one second. I mean, this isn't good for a podcast, but...
I still want to see.
I have this from my 2006 trip still.
Oh, I love that. Is he wearing, like, an inner tube?
He is, and he's drinking beer, and he has pickled cucumbers, and it says, don't mind. I don't know what the Japanese says, because my Japanese is pretty bad, but I think I paid 1,000 yen for it.
So that's awesome.
I might get a tattoo of this guy. I don't know. He looks cool.
He looks really chill. You can't see this on the podcast, obviously, but there's just this Kappa sitting, chilling, drinking a beer with an inner tube.
Anytime I get too stressed out, I look at the little don't mind Kappa, so.
Just inherit his traits. Be cool, drink beer, float. Yeah, so I think another thing that has made Five Nights at Freddy's stand out and stand the test of time over the years is that it's not just the jump scares, and it's not even like the lore well, it is, but the way that the animatronics sneak around and kind of taunt you as you try to keep your body together can be genuinely terrifying. Like, there's a moment I recall very, well, probably recall for the rest of my life, where I was looking through the cameras, and I looked at the kitchen, because, of course, the animatronics are always clanging around in there. There's that sound design again. And Bonnie, the bunny, was just staring at me with, like, these pinprick white pupil eyes lost in a void of black. And I'm like, holy shit, I'm never sleeping again. Jesus Christ. And that's actually, like, I think Scott Cawthon's Christian background ironically helped him with, like, really, you know, seal the scares in Five Nights at Freddy's, like seal their like, what they were like. Because, obviously, as a Christian developer, he's not going to make kids' games full of blood and gore. As you said earlier, there is that definitely the suggestion of dead children. And, you know, to be honest, that does surprise me a little bit, given Cawthon's morals and whatnot. But, yeah, there's not a whole lot you can object to in terms of blood, bad words, sex, anything like that. It's just not exactly G, but it certainly doesn't go over PG-13. I think the movie was PG-13, if I'm not mistaken.
PG-13, I think I'd say a pretty soft one. I mean, yeah. One can only hope Peter Jackson gets his turn to do a Meet the Feebles version of Five Nights at Freddy's.
Oh, man, I love that. Or Del Toro. I'd love to see a
that'd be cool.
Del Toro a version of Five Nights at Freddy's. I don't know if he's a fan, though. So I'm still waiting on that Hobbit movie.
Man, I wish they'd do his version as a comic or something. I don't know. Like I think that would have been really something.
Yeah, I would absolutely consume that from beginning to end. And yeah, it's a rather short game, I will give it that. So it's probably why there's not a whole lot to say about it beyond, like, the fact that it has survived so long as a meme, and kids nowadays, I call them kids even though they're not kids anymore, but say someone was 10 when they grew up with Five Nights at Freddy's, now they're 20, now they're like us looking back and saying, oh, I'm so old, and I tell you to shut up because you're 20 years old, but I understand the sentiment, which is the staying power of Five Nights at Freddy's. We have not had a game in a little bit, except for the new one that came out, which was Help Wanted 2. Sorry, that was actually 2003, so that wasn't very long ago after all, but I think that was actually a VR2 launch as well. Yeah, so it's hanging in there.
It looks like the second Five Nights at Freddy's movie comes out in December 5th, 2025.
Okay, so, yeah.
So where it goes with the lore, like, who knows? There's a lot of places it can go, and with all the fan-made games, and I think it's going to be around for a while, even though it's not in its heyday.
Yeah, just it's funny, as you said, Chuck E. Cheese is all but dead, and I see it getting deader as time goes on, but I think that just the aesthetic of, oh my god, machines out of control in a pizza parlor is just an endearing, it's almost like the campground that you have, like, oh, classic slasher area, or the school, another classic slasher movie area, but, or, you know, slumber party. So now you have the haunted pizza parlor kind of up there with them. And what's funny about that is, I don't know, have you ever watched Gravity Falls?
Man, been a long time, but a little bit.
Yeah, there was an episode, you may or may not remember it, because it was very vivid, where Seuss had a digital girlfriend who turned a bunch of pizza parlor animatronics into murderers.
Oh.
And yeah, that was like very waifu energy, because Seuss, of course, is a gamer, and not an incel. He's a very sweet guy, but he's not exactly unawkward. So yeah, you had these animatronics in this pizza parlor being controlled by this girl animated by sprite animator Paul Robinson, who's incredible at what he does. But this came out like weeks, maybe days before Five Nights at Freddy's really took off. So people used to ask Alex Hirsch, the creator of the show, like, was this episode inspired by Five Nights at Freddy's? He said, no, it's just a coincidence that it happened. So it's just funny that you had two ideas rising at the same time, and it was all based on animatronics and video games that can be taken control of very easily and that will turn into murderous monsters.
Yeah, and It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia in one of the recent seasons had something set like in a Chuck E. Cheese.
I'm only just starting to watch It's Always Sunny, so I haven't gotten there yet, but that sounds pretty funny.
Right. So, I mean, this, and what, there's all the YouTube videos of, I forget the name of the groups, but they'll take the old animatronics and then make them play other music.
Yes.
Kind of modify the robotics.
I've seen that done. There's actually a music video where someone did alongside to Neighborhood Number One by Arcade Fire, which is a very melancholy song about the apocalypse. And they spliced it with footage of what movie was it? The Day After Tomorrow, which is the nuclear disaster movie. So there's spliced like footage of this gorilla playing playing piano and the singing bear alongside like nuclear explosions and Minuteman missiles taking off and going to Russia. It's a pretty great music video. Very suitable for its source song, I think. Yeah, so Matt, I think we've gone over almost everything that Five Nights at Freddy's has to offer. You mentioned the second movie. I am looking forward to that. I might watch it on a plane, but I will watch it. And I do wonder if it will continue the storyline the movie started, or if Scott Cawthon's going to start everything all over again. I don't know. I think maybe we'll find the movie will have links to the first movie, but it will seem totally different at first glance, which is kind of the nature of Five Nights at Freddy's games.
And maybe with Scott Cawthon's, you know, religious influences, and since it is done by Blumhouse, maybe it'll be a crossover with their Exorcist reboots they're doing.
Oh, that would be really awesome. Like, can you imagine, like, the Exorcist, but you have to get kids' spirits out of the animatronics? Yeah. It's not totally unlike what the stories go for, so.
That's true.
Do it. Just hire me, Scott Cawthon. Just hire me to write it. I will write it. But for now, that is it for this week on Retronauts. Thank you so much for joining me at this plastic tablecloth printed with happy animal musicians. If you like what we do, please support us on Patreon at patreon.com/retronauts. A monthly pledge of $3 gets you episodes a week early and ad-free. A monthly pledge of $5 gets you all of that, plus 2 exclusive episodes a month, extra episodes. We do have a $64 tier, as in Nintendo 64, and if you are a member of that tier for 6 months, you get your choice of topic. You can suggest a topic, but right now, as of this recording, all those spaces are filled, so you snooze, you lose. Keep an eye out, and maybe the tier spot will open up again. For now, Matt, where the heck can we find you?
Yeah, if you go to matwbt.com, or if you go on Twitter and look up matwbt, you can find my stuff. I also have a Substack called The Film Flam Man at matwbt.substack.com, where I review kind of, you know, genre movies and do interviews, which is a lot of fun.
That sounds awesome.
I'm currently working on a book about the Doom video game and movies. That's D-O-O-M, not D-U-N-E.
Doom.
Right, Doom. And as you know, I've just sort of started doing interviews for it, and I was really shocked at QuakeCon they re-released Doom 1 and 2 yet again with like 2 brand new campaigns.
That's awesome.
Along with modern quality of life improvements.
Doom will never die. Doom can run on a pregnancy test. I don't know if that's true or not. I can't remember if that was a shitpost, but it's probably true.
I think so. And I also will plug the Uwe Boll's memoir that I was an editor on and wrote the foreword for. Look up Uwe Boll book on Amazon.
Right.
It's called, and he, if you like him, he has a podcast called Uwe Boll Raw. It does episodes in English and in German that are on different topics. So depending on how much Uwe Boll you want to take, there's options out there for you. It was really, you know, with his memoir, and then I'll shut up about Uwe Boll. I was really blown away by the blurbs we got for it.
Mm-hmm.
The one we have
I
on
bet.
The cover is from Amanda Plummer, who worked on his latest film. And she says, I would work with Uwe Boll on a drop of a dime. I love him.
He was a very outspoken guy when it came to his kind of bad films at the time.
Yes. And anyhow, you know, it's cool that he's back in filmmaking again after doing restaurant stuff. And I'll keep on, you know, writing video game books. I think partially because they didn't exist when I was a kid. You could find movie books. You could find music books. The first one, the first two I ever read were Stephen L. Kent's The First Quarter. I think it was later changed to Ultimate History of Video Games. And, oh, I can't remember the guy's name, but it was, I think, called Game Over, A History of like Nintendo by David Sheff, I think.
David Sheff. Yeah, that was like the only thing we had for a very long time. That was the history book.
And so I think we've gotten, do you think we've gotten more video game books over the years? I think we have. Like, I think we'll continue.
Maybe a few. I might be working on one, just saying.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I brought up at work that I did a Star Trek video games book, and some older people said, why would you do a book about video games? But
why
then
not?
Who cares? And like, and then when I did my presentation at Star Trek to Las Vegas, my hardcover sales in one of the categories jumped up from 330 to 30. So it shows, I think there is a market for it, and there's more video games out there that will continue to be made. And I picked the topic of Star Trek video games because it's Star Trek, it's popular, and like they'll be making those games for a long time.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree with you. And I mean, this whole episode has been about a niche that is, you know, it seems like who the hell is going to want to be so obsessive about a game about Chuck E. Cheese? But there you go. And speaking about books, this series has a lot of books attached to it.
Is there a book you'd recommend in particular?
Oh, that's a good question. There are so many and they're so scattered that it's really hard to say yes.
You said
to
some
any
of the short ones, right? There's like short stories or something.
Yes, that's right. There are like short story collections. Of course, I can't remember the name of them off the top of my head. I just kind of go on Kindle and buy them. But also there's graphic novels of those story collections. So if you want to like read faster, that's a good way to do it.
Sure.
So, but I find that the books, they're not just written by Scott. They're written by several people. And some of the prose is pretty good. There's a couple of really good, it kind of reminds me of, remember when you were a kid and you'd read like scary stories for kids and To Read in the Dark or whatever it was called, the series?
Yeah. Oh man, the one I loved was Captain N the Game Master, which does not hold up, but I think I'll do a book about it one day because it was like media of different franchises crossing over in really, you know, inaccurate ways with Levi Stubbs of the Four Tops doing Mother Brain or Mega Man with a smoker's cough and he's green.
Mega. God, that was Mother Brain, voiced by Levi Strauss, I think it
Stubbs. Yep.
Audrey
the same
too.
Voice of Audrey too, yeah, from Little Shop of
Horrors.
Who's
just an incredible performer. Well, missed very, very much.
Yeah, one of my sound design professors was, as a kid, really good at alto sax, so he got to tour at the Four Tops for a summer.
Oh, I'm jealous. That's really cool.
He said it was extraordinary. And like they were just like machines and knew their stuff backwards and forwards. But you had to know the whole songbook because they would change things last minute to see if you could keep up with them. So
that's awesome. That's a mark of talent right there. Just like, you know what? I'm going to screw with this. Keep up or don't. I don't care. Speaking of keeping up, you can keep up with me at Nadia Oxford on the social medias. I am also the co-host of the Acts of the Blood God podcast. We cover RPGs old and new, Eastern and Western. We just had a big stream for Trans Lifeline. We raised $18,000, and we have all kinds of crazy promises that we're going to fulfill now. So please join us at patreon.com/bloodgodpod. We want to see you on our Discord, so make sure you support us. But until next time, if you don't want a hook in your eye, you best not be peeking behind Foxy's curtain. Grrrr.